Hello and welcome to the American Security Project. Thank you for coming today, and thanks for coming on a Friday. We don't often host events on Friday, but we thought this was a good one, and the timing was right. And with everything going on, we've got the budget negotiations on the Hill. We've got the end of the COP in Paris. We've got all sorts of things happening, and most importantly to Steve, we've got Steve and Leo, we've got the Army-Navy game this weekend. So lots of things going on, and of course the holiday season. So thank you for taking the time to come and join us today and follow along. We're excited to have a great panel. This is our closing event for a series of events we've done around the country on climate change and national security. We've been everywhere from Pittsburgh to Las Vegas, from Texas to Charleston, Florida to Colorado, all across the country, talking about the impacts of climate change on national security to a variety of audiences, everything from mayors to state senators, from Chamber of Commerce groups to VFW halls, talking about all of this. And so we thought that this would be a good opportunity to, first of all, hear from the Department of Defense on their climate adaptation plans and what they're doing on climate change, and then also hear from General Cheney and Captain Goff about what they have seen and understood during General Cheney will talk about our ASP climate tour, and Captain Goff will talk about CNA's similar tour going around the country, CNA MAB's similar tour going around the country, which we did through a partnership with the European Union Embassy here in D.C. So thanks to them for their support of all of this. And my role here is to introduce and then briefly get out of the way. So I will briefly introduce our speakers here, and then I'll turn it over to Maureen to address the audience here. She'll talk for about 10 or 15 minutes, then we'll turn it over to General Cheney and Captain Goff. And then I'll have a couple of questions, and we'll open it to questions from you all. First, Ms. Maureen Sullivan is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Environment, Safety, and Occupational Health in the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense, Energy Installations and Environment. Got it all, right? She is responsible for DOD's policies and programs related to compliance with environmental laws and a range of other things. She is a real professional. Her DOD career spans 35 years prior to being in the Office of Secretary of Defense. She's held positions with Defense Logistics Agency in Virginia, Michigan, Ohio, Germany, and she's been a member of the SES since 2008. It is a privilege to have her here talking about this. But before I turn it over to you, okay. I'll introduce General Cheney, is ASP's CEO. He's a member of the Department of State's Foreign Affairs Policy Board, graduated of the Naval Academy, as you can see. Over 30 years of experience as a Marine, and his final command in the Marine Corps was as commanding general of Parris Island in South Carolina, the Marine Recruits Training Depot. Dr. Leo Goff is the program manager for CNA's Military Advisory Board, which is a group of retired 3- and 4-star flag and general officers from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. Focus of their last several years has been on climate, energy, and national security. He's a retired Navy captain, having served for 30 years in submarines or working at the strategic leadership level in the Pentagon. He was the commanding officer of a nuclear submarine and a submarine tender. He retired in 2011 and is had a distinguished career at CNA since then. And I count him as a friend, and I see him at a lot of the same events. So we're happy to have him here. And with that, I'll get off the stage and turn it over to Ms. Maureen Sullivan. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for this opportunity to come and talk to you a little bit about what the Department of Defense is doing. I'm going to try and set the stage. Why does DOD care about climate change? Well, the truth is we care for two fundamental reasons. One is the missions that we have. So when and where we have to engage, when and where we needed for humanitarian assistance. Now, I'm not going to talk about any of that. That's in another section of the Department of Defense. But that's part of why we care. Another part is how we perform our missions. What are our capabilities? How are we trained, equipped, and ready for us? And that's where I get more involved. So climate change is a risk. And the Department of Defense does one thing really well. We deal with risk. And it's ingrained into us to think about things in terms of what are the risks of various scenarios and how are we prepared to respond to this scenario. So climate change fits well into that concept. So what we need to do, what our job is to do, is to make sure that we build resilience into our infrastructure, into our military capability, so that we can continue to perform our missions. So ask the basic question, do we have the capability and capacity to continue to train, test, train, and equip? So that's fundamentally why we care, because a changing climate presents these scenarios to us that could impede our ability, and we need to be prepared to respond. So what are we doing in the Department of Defense? Well, I'm going to guess this is a somewhat informed audience, so you're familiar with the first step, which was the roadmap that we published well over a year ago in October of 2014. Secretary Hagel announced it in Lima, Peru. The focus of the roadmap was incorporating how we adapt, how we are incorporating adapting to climate change across our missions and functions. Not a standalone program, but that integration. And that's going to be a theme you're going to hear throughout my remarks. There were three goals in that roadmap, and you're going to hear these a couple of times. So one is identify and assess the effects of climate change on the department. So here's a risk. Let's identify that risk. Number two, integrate climate change considerations across the department and manage the associated risks. So again, integrate into our normal decision-making process, and again, that risk concept. And three was collaborate with internal and external stakeholders on climate change challenges. And that's going to be the third part of my remarks today. I'm going to talk a lot about that. But you hear this theme of identify and assess the risks, integrated into normal business processes and ultimately manage those risks. So the next step is, in our mind, we have the roadmap, we've got the department on this path, but we're the Department of Defense. We're rule followers. So what we need to do is, the next step was, let's institutionalize this. And within the Department of Defense, that means we need what's called a DOD directive. And those are the rule sets that we operate. So we have drafted the directive. It is inching its way to the Undersecretary, Mr. Frank Kendall, for signature. We are actually hoping that it will be signed next week. So stay tuned. We will post it on our website as soon as we can. It has a number. So once it has a number in our terms, that actually, it means we're very close to signature. It's going to be 4715.21. So we're close. So the directive, in a typical Department of Defense structure, it has a policy section. And the policy section pretty clearly states that DOD must be able to adapt current and future operations to address the impacts of climate change in order to maintain an effective and efficient military. So, and then it goes on to say, mission planning and execution must include these themes again, identification and assessment of the effects of climate change on the DOD mission, take those effects into consideration when developing plans and implementing procedures, and anticipate and manage any risks that develop as a result of climate change to build resilience. So we're back to those themes, identify and assess the risk, and integrate it into normal decision-making processes. So the other thing that's standard in one of these issuances is whose responsibility, the responsibility section, who has to do this. And basically, it lays it out for everybody in the Department of Defense. Nobody escapes. There are requirements for almost every organization in there, specifically laid out and implied. So this will be pretty ground-changing for the department, and it will set us on the path. Now, there have been a couple of interim policies that we've issued. We issued one on construction in floodplains. I don't know if you're familiar with that one. So in our military construction program, what we've said is stop, assess, and decide. So if we're going to do construction in a, we're not saying don't construct in a floodplain. Obviously, we're not going to move a major Navy base. Navy base kind of has to be in a floodplain, but assess the risks associated with being in the floodplain and ensure you've built resilience into that. Another one that we've issued is on water management, to put in structures in place to make sure installations understand how much water they have access to, where that water is coming from, who they're competing with for that water, and that they have plans on prioritization if water availability shrinks down. Now we're seeing the effects, and I know Leo's excited about this. So in the FY16 President's budget request, the Army had two interesting military construction projects that, for me, I felt tested the water of how this is going to be the reception on the Hill. So one of them is actually at West Point. It's a wastewater treatment plant. It's a $70 million project. So the wastewater treatment plant is failing. And so they had to build a new wastewater treatment plant. Where climate change comes in, and this is what we talk about, institutionalizing these considerations in your normal planning process, is the current location, West Point, on that hill, down by the river, the wastewater treatment plant was very low. So the decision was part to put this in a higher location so it wouldn't be subject to storm surge risks. The second one was a power train facility in Corpus Christi, Texas, $85 million project. Again, had to build a new facility, mission requirement, but the location was shifted because of climate change considerations. I think that, for me, that was a bellwether. How would the Hill react to that? Because we've had interesting issues about are we investing in climate change or are we not? And they accepted that. Look, at the Department of Defense is looking at it as a risk. You, in incorporating in a normal decision-making process, we made decisions. These projects were needed for mission reasons. The location was because of climate change, and that was perfectly understandable and acceptable to them. I think that was a good bellwether for us. So that's an example of how we want to proceed, is institutionalizing this into normal decision-making process. So let me talk a little bit about vulnerability. So the question becomes, so what are the big risks for our facilities and infrastructure? Right now, the Department of Defense has approximately over 500,000 buildings and structures with a plant replacement value of almost over three quarters of a trillion dollars. It's a lot of infrastructure. So what are the risks? So we actually are just finishing up a screening level vulnerability assessment survey. I'm going to make that so a whole long title. This is a very, very high level qualitative look at what we're already experiencing in terms of climate change issues. We propose to look at 7,000 sites worldwide. We've gotten well over half of them done. Some of the smaller ones, like Guard and Reserve stations, recruiting offices are included in that 7,000, so they went to a lower priority. We looked at extreme weather events, wildfire, changes in mean sea level, and said, what are you experiencing now? And the intent of this, again, it's a qualitative look, is to say, okay, at this top level, we can't address all 7,000 sites at once. Where do we see risks and therefore need to do a deeper dive to see what is going on and how we need to respond to that? I see this as just the beginning of the process. It also helped us, and it was a learning process. What information do the installations have? On the installation has that information? What information do we centrally have that we could provide them, maps, data of some sort? An interesting one is, remember I said 7,000 sites. So it was confusing for some bases where they had remote sites, like a base in Colorado actually has a site in Florida. And they're answering the questions based on Colorado circumstances, not realizing they actually have a site in Florida that they have different climate issues associated with. So it was a learning curve for a lot of us. Like I said, we've done the initial screening. We're preparing a summary report. It'll be very high level. It should be out in the next couple of months that tries to give you a summary of that. But again, it's the kickoff. It's the beginning of the process. So one of the other things I want to talk about, the last thing, is in the roadmap, we talked about collaborating with internal and external stakeholders. And there's a lot going on there that I want to share with you. Our installations, as you can imagine, they're not silos. They're not, independent from the surrounding community. If we have risks associated with climate change, in all likelihood, the community surrounding us also has those risks. So let me talk a little bit. I'm going to divide it in two parts. One, I'm going to talk about domestically within the United States, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about international. So domestically, we were working with the White House. They asked us, they were doing some pilots with some other federal agencies about how to work with, the federal agencies work with communities, and they asked us to do some pilots, which we said, this is a good opportunity for us, because we have to figure out how we're going to work at all these bases, the 500-plus bases, 7,000 sites, how are we going to work with our external community? So in 2014, we kicked off three pilots. They're two-year pilots. The first progress reports will be due early in 2016. The goals with these pilots were to develop a replicable process on how to work with the communities. So it was a learning exercise for us to say, what are the things that we need to look at? We had lots of questions. Who do we work with? How do we work with them? What do the stakeholders bring to the conversation? What do we bring to the conversation? What information do we all need? What's the best way to approach this? So we have three pilots that are going right now. The first one is in Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho, and it is focused on water availability and access. Mountain Home is, and the area around Mountain Home, they're actually running out of water. So lots of issues about, do they have enough water to support the mission? The second one is with the Michigan National Guard. They're doing three locations, Camp Grayling, Fort Custer, in Selfridge are the three. There are many entities involved across the state, and I think the state police are the lead for the state of Michigan, which I found fascinating. It's not the environmental folks, it's the state police. They're looking at topics like extreme heat events, flooding, power outages. They have actually a pretty good fact sheet that's available on what they're doing, the dialogues, and their lessons learned about where to have meetings and who to engage in the process. The third one, which is the most complex and the most challenging, is in the Norfolk area. It's being run by Old Dominion University. They, of course, Norfolk is It's complicated for three basic reasons. Okay, first of all, it's the largest U.S. military presence in the world in one location. Second of all, there are 16 independent local governments, all with various forms of incorporation. And then third, is in the greater area, there are actually different geological problems that they're dealing with. Some are dealing with inundation, sea level rise. Some are dealing with land sinking. There are just various challenges. So, and then, of course, in that area, there's lots of infrastructure. You've got roads, you've got piers, tunnels, bridges, light rail, drinking water, wastewater plants. So there's a lot of complications. There was a big meeting there yesterday with a couple hundred people trying to get their arms around with how do we do this? What do we talk about? We expect to learn a lot from the pilots, but again, it's 2 years, so we're only about halfway through that process. So there's more to come. So the second area is international. In this one, I know I talked at the beginning and said I don't do how we work, you know, our humanitarian assistance and where we are in the world. I don't do that. But I have a little tiny, tiny program called the Defense Environmental International Cooperation Program. It's $1.5 million. It's, like I said, tiny, tiny in DOD standards. So my boss says it's not even a rounding area. But the concept of this program, DEIC, is I'm going to read this because the language is really important. Supports international engagement in the pursuit of the strategic end states identified in the Secretary's guidance for the deployment of the forces, as well as combat commands, theater campaign plans. That's all one sentence. So it's a vehicle for engagement. The combatant commands come to us with proposals on working with countries in their areas of responsibilities to help countries build capacity to establish mill-to-mill partnerships. And we're seeing a trend in those projects that are coming from the COCOMs related to climate change. For the past couple of years, we've sponsored what's called the Pacific Environmental Forum. Last year, there were 22 countries that were in that forum, and that climate change was the big topic. How are they all building? How are they all addressing and building resilience? AFRICOM has done a couple on water capacity building around the Horn of Africa. SouthCOM has a couple this year on water security, and there's going to be a workshop on in the Caribbean on the impact of climate change on military operations, a multinational effort. So to get that dialogue going, again, to build the capacity within these other countries for them to address the and build resilience. So there's a lot going on. As I said earlier, we're close. Any day now, we will have the DOD issuance, the DOD directive in place. So we have the policy structure in place. So now we're moving out smartly to identify all the instructions across the portfolio, the detailed things to say, okay, where does climate change fit in? Natural resource management, in installation management across all the portfolios. I have pest management, how does it fit in that, you know, types of things. We're completing our summary of these assessment surveys and beginning to understand where we next need to go in terms of analysis of the risks and vulnerabilities. We have the pilots, so we'll have the, you know, develop this replicable process so our bases can work with the surrounding communities on these. So I think we have a path forward, and we're moving smartly down it. But again, it's back to the basic concepts that climate change is a risk, and that if we want to have the capability, the long-term capability to test, train, and equip, it's a risk that we must address in order to assure our national security mission. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Sullivan, thank you. We're going to take the podium down here, and
I think there was a lot to chew on there, and I'll leave you all to think about that and turn it over to General Cheney to talk a little bit about ASP's program and what he's learned.
Thanks, Andrew. Maureen, great comments. Thank you for coming. Appreciate you being over here today. I don't usually find myself in the position as the panelist. I'm usually in Andrew's spot as the moderator. But that said, first, let me apologize for Admiral Gunn not being here this afternoon. He's had a medical emergency and could not come. That said, he and I go back almost 20 years. He was the Inspector General for the Navy in 97. I was the Inspector General of the Marine Corps. He was also the Inspector General of the Department of the Navy, and I was the Deputy for the Department of the Navy. So I've known him for a long, long time, and I can cover almost all aspects of what he would have covered today. Let me put out some ad rem remarks first. This is our last event of the year that we're hosting in this building, and it doesn't happen easy. I've got a great staff, and we have some fabulous interns that put this together, so I want to publicly thank all them for what they're doing. Plus that, we've got a number of sponsors and business council members throughout this year who have helped put this together. We're a 501c3, so we're a nonprofit. This is the end of the year. Giving Tuesday was last week, but it's Giving December, so if you get the opportunity, please contribute to us. I am celebrating Navy's victory over Army last night in swimming for the 25th consecutive year for the men and 27th consecutive year for the women, and of course we hope Navy will do number 14 tomorrow against Army. It really has been an amazing couple of years for ASP, and we got a sponsorship from the European Union, and I want to thank them. And they came to us, and CNA as well, and said, hey, can you get outside the Beltway and go across the country and talk climate change? Because we're not sure the message is getting across to the general population. And can you take it from a different perspective from the national security side? And they particularly wanted us to take our military validators with us, one or two flag officers at each stop, or three. And we chose a whole variety of different cities and states to go to. But throughout the whole thing, our message really didn't change, that climate change is a threat multiplier and it's an accelerant to instability. We use those two phrases frequently. And I'm going to quote a little bit from some of our presentations, and maybe it might be a little bit redundant from what Maureen had to say, but I'm going to quote out of the QDR. The impacts of climate change may increase the frequency, scale, and complexity of future missions, including defense support to civil authorities, while at the same time undermining the capacity of our domestic installation to support training activities. And I will tell you, we've got bases and stations here in the United States and all over the world that are threatened by climate change, not the least of which, of course, is Norfolk. Look at places like Diego Garcia, which will probably go underwater. Eglin Air Force Base had to close a couple of times last year because it was flooded. They all recognize that climate change is impacting the physical portion of our bases and stations as well, and it's contributing to instability worldwide. And this is another hour-long presentation, so I won't bore you with the details today, but you can partially tie the Syrian crisis to climate change. You can certainly tie what happened in Mali to climate change, the Boko Haram with Lake Chad drying up. A lot of that's movement because of climate change, and we can draw that thread. Certainly when Admiral Locklear a couple of years back said climate change was his number one threat, he took a lot of flack for it. But long-term, it is the number one threat. That ship has left the station. We are polluting the atmosphere at record rates. The place is heating up like crazy. If we don't do something about it, it's just going to get incredibly worse. As you all know, COP21 was supposed to finish today. It might finish tomorrow. We'll see what they come up with. But we're here to talk the national security perspective of it. So what I'd like to do for just a couple of minutes is talk about some of the highlights of some of our trips. And it wasn't just our preaching this message to the people there. We were there to listen from them as well. And it's just some amazing anecdotal information that we got. And we started off in Pittsburgh in February of 2014. That was kind of our shakedown cruise. We picked it because it was kind of close. We could drive there and we could get Admiral Titley, who runs the Penn State program, and he's the former meteorologist of the Navy. He knows climate change backwards and forwards. So if you've ever had a question about climate change, go to him. He'll answer it for you. But I can tell you this, don't go to Pittsburgh in February. Climate change be damned. It was 5 below 0. And the windows on our car froze, and we couldn't get them down. Now, that said, we had an interesting reception there. We went to the University of Pittsburgh. The administration there was, I would say they were ambivalent about our showing up. and we had a luncheon event there, and they said, well, we'll give you a room about this size, and we're not sure if anybody's coming. Widely oversubscribed. Well over 100 to 150, mostly students and some faculty and staff. I mean, it just blew us away as our first major public event that many people were really interested in climate change, particularly in Pittsburgh. Now, with each one of these cities we went to, we also published a paper afterwards talking about the vulnerability of that particular city to climate change and the impacts it's going to have there, too. So they were interesting. We didn't always go to friendly audiences. In Pittsburgh, thanks to my events coordinator, Porter Brockway, back there, he scheduled us to go to a fracking company. And I thought, this one will really, really be interesting. And indeed, it was. Clearly, the president of the company wanted to sell his gas and oil. And we sat down. He was a total denier. And Admiral Titley gave his entire brief. And I think at the end of the brief, the guy just had nothing he could say to counter what we had to say about climate change. Now, that didn't mean I convinced him. But nonetheless, you get the point that if you present them the facts and you let them understand what it is, some people are going to change a little bit. In most of these cities, we usually had an editorial roundtable, or we sat down with a local TV, radio station, or PBS station. We did that in Pittsburgh as well, and it was particularly successful. Now, that said, our next stop was in San Francisco. Do go there in February. Another interesting audience there, a little bit more friendly, as you probably would imagine. We did a couple of events in downtown San Francisco. Welcome reception, all oversubscribed, a lot of interest there. Moved on to go to Las Vegas. One of our reasons for going there was to talk about water and water conservation, and also to stop by Nellis Air Force Base. If you haven't been there, they have a solar array that'll just blow you away. It's huge. And they're trying to become a net zero base, meaning they produce more energy than they consume, and they're well on their way to doing that. Las Vegas has got some phenomenal water management. You wouldn't believe it, but they do. We also went out to the Hoover Dam in Lake Mead, and I know, Leo, you were just there last week. We were there a year and a half ago. Lake Mead then was at its lowest level in history, and it's continued to go down. What's interesting is how water is managed in the southwestern United States, and there's a Colorado River compact between seven states, and it is kind of the model for international water management. And while we were at the Hoover Dam, they were talking about this, and then we went down to the Central Arizona Project, and a lot of countries are coming to them to look at the legal framework that we use to manage water in that section of the country, particularly China came in and looked at it there too. And of course, from there we went down to Phoenix. This is an astounding fact. Arizona water usage is now at 1955 levels, despite a population increase of 5 million. Can you believe that? And a lot of the reason is a lot of the water they get is from Lake Mead. The Central Arizona Project manages that water. It's all done in conduits that are lined by concrete. Their seepage is almost negligible, and they really manage their water well. Leo played golf in Scottsdale last week. All the golf courses are lush green. It's all gray water. All of it's wastewater. They will not allow you to water any of those golf courses with regular water. So it's just astounding what they do there. In contrast, in California, there's a 20% plus water loss coming out of Lake Mead, the water that goes to California, because the conduits are not lined with concrete and it just seeps through. You'd think we would fix that, but we haven't. Now, here's an oxymoron for you. The water coming out of Lake Mead is pumped up over the mountains to the south, and then it runs down to Phoenix and Tucson, gravity-fed. But you got to pump it up first. One of the largest coal-burning power plants in the country is what pumps that water up there. Now, I just found that astounding and rather sad, to be honest with you. And a couple of more anecdotal stories here. We went to New Orleans. New Orleans, of course, is no stranger to catastrophic weather, and they know the threat. But here's another interesting, to me, astounding fact. The Delta south of New Orleans loses a football field worth of land every 45 minutes. A football field worth of land. Now, there's a variety of factors that contribute to this. Clearly, seawater, sea level rise is part of it. Another part of it is if you go down and fly over it, there are hundreds of miles of canals that have been dug mostly by Texaco and abandoned, and they never filled them in when they left. And there's several lawsuits pending about this. I doubt they'll be settled. But most of those canals are falling in, and as a consequence, the water land level is going down. They're trying to reclaim it. It isn't going to work. Eventually, it will all go underwater, and what you'll see is New Orleans, it'll be kind of like the Netherlands, I suspect, all surrounded by dikes, and everything else will be water. We'd had a couple of really good experiences in New Orleans. We went to Tulane, and it was, again, kind of an ambivalent audience, not as big as it was at University of Pittsburgh. But then we went over to Dillard University, and I hadn't heard of Dillard. Dillard's a predominantly black school, and we lucked into their conference on climate change. And they had, I would say, 19 or 20 predominantly black schools that were there all represented, and we ended up spending hours there with them, intense interest in climate change and the impact on their local communities and their schools, and I just found that, quite frankly, heartwarming. And I'll close with two other stories. We did go to Fort Sam Houston outside of San Antonio, and we stopped by Army Installation Command, and our DOD and our services really are tackling this problem head on, and they've got a huge program with the Army on installation to do the same thing, to go to net zero, and they understand it, and they're working hard, and it's a phenomenal program. And there's a tactical advantage to all this. You know, the number one consumer of fossil fuels in the United States is the Department of Defense. And they realize it's a huge vulnerability. When you talk about the supply trains that we've had in Afghanistan and Iraq, mostly carrying oil and water or gas and water, we would like to get off that vulnerability if we could. We'd like to not have to power our generators. We'd rather use solar power. I can tell you the Marine that's on the combat outpost who has to lug batteries or diesel fuel up to that combat outpost would much rather set up a small solar array, power recharge the batteries, and then not have to do it for his electronics. So, I mean, there's a lot more to this than just being green and saving pollution of CO2. And as I'm sure you're all aware, almost all our aircraft have run on some form of biofuels, which, by the way, reminds me, we did stop by the FedEx facility in Tennessee, Memphis, Fred Smith's place in Memphis. All his planes at one time or another have been run on biofuels, and he's trying to get all his vehicles to run on natural gas. So FedEx has a huge, huge program to go green. Our last stop here last month was in Charleston. And it's just Charleston, if you've not been, my last command was Parris Island, and I'd gone to Charleston quite a bit. Most of the Marines, recruits going to Parris Island, fly into Charleston. But the last time I was down there was about 10 years ago. It has just exploded down there. Industry is going crazy. And Boeing is building all their 787 Dreamliners at the Boeing at the Charleston airport. Little fact that I didn't know till we went down there, that entire plant is self-sufficient, all powered by solar power. They're selling power back to the city of Charleston. I found it just amazing. And while we were there, we went to the Clemson University Restoration Institute. They took over the old naval base that's there. Interestingly, they built a huge facility there in 1986 or 87, and BRAC rolled in about 2 years later and closed it all. Clemson stuck his hand in the air and took control of the facility. But what they do there is they test wind turbines worldwide. And so if a company's building a wind turbine, but they want to check the stresses on those turbines, they'll use that facility. And they have a mock-up there, the biggest mock-up in the world that's used for testing purposes. They don't have the actual blades. They use electric power to turn it, but they test the forces on the turbine. It's a 7.5 megawatt turbine, and you know the normal blade for one of these turbines, the blade alone, one, is 280 feet long. I mean, the size, I just had no comprehension of how big these really were. And this is another astounding fact to me. When you look at those huge blades on the turbines, the fastest speed would be 20 revolutions per minute, and you can see the blades turning. Inside, the motor is turning at over 2,000 RPM. That's how it's geared down. I mean, really think about it. It's just astounding. So that's seven or so out of the 20 cities we went to, and I think at Charleston, the last question I was asked by a guy from the Charleston Courier, he said, you think you made a difference? And it is really a tough question to answer. But I think we did. And am I saying we're going to go out and turn the tide in the country on climate change and make all the dyers, you know, flip? No. But I can tell you, to me, overwhelmingly, almost every city that we went to had a concern about it. And I would also say, and this is just my side of it, I think the mayors, in many cases, are more concerned about it than the governors are, or perhaps even more in some cases than our Congress is. The mayors get it. They understand the threat. It's varying degrees depending on the city and the vulnerability of them. But they're very interested in hearing the national security side of it. It brings it home to them. and it just paints it from a different perspective. So that all said, we're going to keep going on this. We hope to get another grant and push it farther into the next year. It's going to be a big program for us over here in the next 12 to 24 months. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Captain Leo Goff.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to echo what Steve said. So I have the privilege of working with the 16 admirals on the Military Advisory Board, and I've had an opportunity to go out and speak myself to some of the various locations. And much like ASP, in conjunction with this EU grant, we've gone around the country, seven focus states, and probably in the same model that ASP does, what we try to do is go to a state or a region and spend a good day or two there and meet with a wide variety of folks, very similar as both Andrew and Steve indicated, everything from the VFW to the governor and everywhere in between. The people on the Military Advisory Board have testified before the legislatures, met with a great deal in a number of universities, and frequently are invited to town hall events. But the one thing that I think is, if you didn't get from Steve's presentation, and he mentioned it, but I just wanted to elaborate on it, because these organizations are focused on military members and military talking about climate change, it opens some pretty interesting doors. So, again, governors, legislators, but you get to talk to a lot of conservative organizations that come there and really, you know, they're very focused on security, and they don't understand how there's a linkage between climate change and security. So that's one of the first things and one of the biggest lessons learned that both that I have taken away from the times that I've talked and that the feedback that I've got from the Military Advisory Board is just how eye-opening it is to many people that there is this link between climate change and security. And those of you that, you know, have been attuned to the current presidential politics, you know, understand that that's a raging debate. And, you know, certainly we've had some come out very strongly that say that is our number one security, and others say, how can you say that when we've got ISIS breathing down our neck? Well, as Steve indicated, the two aren't necessarily independent, and they certainly are related. And while the linkages are challenging, those that have been in the community and understand these things like ISIS don't just start overnight, they are built on a host series of events, can understand how climate change actually contributes to those. We've had the opportunity to work with interesting partners on these state evolutions, including the British Embassy. We went out to a couple of states with them, both in the rubric of the EU, but in their own capacity. So we thank you for that. And what's interesting in this capacity, we also bring with us often Neil Morissette, who many of you are familiar with. He accompanied us on several of these tours. And to give you a sense of the dichotomy of the two tours, and I don't have the specific details that Steve did, but I do want to talk to you briefly about Texas and Florida. So General Ken Eichmann is a member of the Military Advisory Board. He is a resident professor there at the University of Texas at Austin, so a natural fit to go to Texas and talk about climate change. He's well-received as a state expert, so to speak, so he wasn't somebody from Washington coming in and talking about things that they didn't know about. And as you might imagine, in Texas, they were very interested in Texas. They've got their own electric grid, and a large producer of our natural gas and oil. And we thought that would be a pretty hostile audience going into Texas, because when we talk about climate, we also talk about energy and how the two are related, and how the Military Advisory Board ascribes to the fact that if we reduce our dependence on oil, specifically foreign oil, it improves our national security, but it also helps us solve some of the challenges that we've got with climate change, and that's how we approach this in a lot of respects. And what we found interesting in Texas is that certainly the legislature and others were well attuned to the dynamics, or the overall dynamics of climate change. At that time when we went to Texas, they were still experiencing their four-year drought, so their reservoirs were very low. And in fact, in the eastern part of Texas, they were subject to brownouts, and they would have had brownouts except for they have one of the largest wind-producing capabilities in the country. So the fact that water, energy, and climate are so interlinked is something that can resonate around the country. And we've found that from Iowa. When you talk to, you know, people in Iowa who are embracing solar and wind and bio and landfill gas conversion as ways to reduce their dependence on oil, but also to stimulate economic growth in the area, plus to reduce the cost of the farm, because if you use the methane that's being produced naturally by waste produced by your cows and pigs, you don't have to buy oil if you can recycle that. So you can approach it from various different points. And there's an economic way to approach it. There's a reducing our dependence on foreign oil as a method of improving our and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And really, a lot of it depends on which audience that you're talking to, how you approach this. So Texas, as I said, it's about water, and it's about wind, and it's about making sure that you can produce the energy that's necessary. In Florida, it was really surprising because the feedback that we got is they don't seem to be that concerned about sea level rise, although that's one of the biggest challenges that they will have. But their near-term focus is on the international economic impact that climate will have, because Florida is a much more international-flavored state, and they do a great deal of trade internationally with the UK and others. So how climate change is impacting the global economy is of great interest to a lot of the business people that we talk to in Florida. Same with Minneapolis-St. Paul. And you wouldn't recognize that, but again, a large European flavor, so that the international aspects in various parts of the country are the thing that resonates of greatest significance. So the resounding message that I and others have heard, again, because we're able to reach a wide variety of audiences, some of them come quite skeptical because they've been listening to talk radio and they've been listening to Fox News and others, not to disparage any of those, but they've got a mindset that this is either not real or it's not happening. And one of the things that I and others like to point out is that the challenge is that climate is a 30-year phenomenon. And we keep looking at it in these little sectors, and it's hard to examine it over a 30-year period when we're focused on next quarter's output and what the economic impact is near term. Or so there's two things, and Maureen has heard this. Climate is a 30-year phenomenon. And then you get the retort that, well, the climate of the globe has always been changing, so it's going to continue to change. That's true, but it's never, ever, ever changed when there's been 7.3 billion people. And that's the takeaway from a security point of view. It's about the people. I'm a fan of dinosaurs. I like them. I like to watch shows of them. But I don't care that they went away. I do care about 7 billion or 8 billion people being impacted by this thing called climate change. And our job as security experts is to figure out how to minimize the impact on the largest number of people, or make it a positive impact if you can. But certainly right now, much of it seems to be on a negative impact. So that's why the military is interested in this, and that's what we tell the people around the country, is that that's why it's a military problem, because it's about the security. And there's only been a couple of times when the nation has been existentially threatened. Back in 1812 when the Brits tried to take us back. Thanks to Neil Morissette. He says they're still trying to take us back. Civil War, that was kind of internal. But the other times, World War I and World War II, they certainly could have been existential threats to the nation. And they were all started not in this country. They're all started overseas. So, the people of the country understand that global events impact our security. And that's one of the reasons that we are engaged around the world. And most of the people want us that way. There's a few isolations that says we shouldn't be. Most of the country still ascribes to the fact that we have a military that needs to be engaged to try to stop these conflicts from happening before A, they reach our shores, or B, they become so large that we are sucked into a World War I or World War II aspect. So when you approach climate change and it increasing conflict, and as Steve pointed out, as a threat, either as a threat multiplier or an accelerant of instability, it really resonates that people can see that, you know, where climate change, because it will evolve, it will most likely limit the number of resources in a given area, and with limited resources, the probability of poor governance being able to manage those resources propels itself into areas where there can be conflict. And, you know, everybody in the country knows that when there's conflict around the globe, we have a tendency to send our troops in to try to quell that or to respond in a humanitarian situation. So that's the kind of the message that resonates. You know, they say all politics is local. So as Steve pointed out, the mayors are getting it. The mayors are very concerned. You know, you talk to the mayor of Indianapolis, a former Air Force colonel. You know, he is doing wonderful things in Indianapolis to make that a renewable city. And he's doing that from an economic point of view. But he also knows that there's a security implication to that as well. So all politics are local. The ones on the coast are more concerned. The ones that are in the Midwest and have aquifer challenges, they get it. But when you talk to people and you ascribe to them and you make them understand that, you know, we in the military are concerned not because of it's necessarily going to threaten us today, but it certainly is an increasing threat 10, 20, 30 years down the road. You highlight to the people out in the country that, you know, we build an aircraft carrier that usually lasts between 50 and 80 years. So it would be good to know what the security environment is in 80 years, as opposed to saying what's going to be tomorrow, because you can't just build an aircraft carrier or an airplane or a B-52 or, you know, whatever, and have it go out and fight today's battles. You've got to prepare your military, as Maureen indicated, or our bases or infrastructure, to be ready to, you know, provide the national security into the future, not just today. So those are the kind of the messages that we've been taking back and that have been resonating. Again, when you couch it in the terms of how it's related to energy and water, that certainly resonates across a broader spectrum of the nation. And knowing who your audiences are and the type of questions that may be coming from that has been very helpful as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Andrew and stand by for any questions.
Thanks, Leo. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Maureen. Wonderful presentations. And I think really important, a great summary of 2 years of work that we've done here and a great summary of everything that the DOD is doing. I'm going to take my prerogative as moderator to ask a couple questions here before I open it out to the floor. So think about anything that you want to ask any of our panelists here. Maureen, quick question for mm-hmm. you. Is there a governance structure in place for the forthcoming DOD climate directive?
You mean organizationally?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a senior sustainability council, actually, that is chaired by the Assistant Secretary for Energy Installations and Environment. It includes the military departments and all of the various OSD offices, including the joint staff. And so they are the governance. Okay. So it includes policy. It includes logistics and material readiness, comptroller, general counsel, of course. You can't go anywhere without your attorney. And they are the governance structure.
Okay. You talked about 500,000 structures, three quarters of a $1 trillion
right.
value of everything, and kind of you've gone down to 7,000 sites and
yeah.
all of this.
Lots of numbers.
It's lots of numbers, and they're big numbers.
Yes.
And it's a big deal. So I guess my question for you is, is the DOD resourced enough for this mission? Is this a challenge in finding the resources to do these analyses, these pilot programs, these you know, integrating it in.
Well, I mean, part of it, you know, the message that I've said is this has got to be part of our normal business. So it's not that there would be additional staff or additional money. It is how do we do the current business? So, for example, we're going to have to do, we have to write an integrated natural resource management plan for every installation to manage the species and ensure that the ranges are available to use for training and that we don't have this conflict between species and training, which is a huge problem in the Department of Defense if anybody's ever dealt with the red-cockaded woodpecker or the desert tortoise. If you've been Fort Irwin, you know what the desert tortoise is. So the question is, it's not a separate plan. It is when you're doing that plan, how do you then think about climate change and what it's going to impact in terms of that species and habitat movement and therefore going to impact your land management? So it's not a new requirement, but in essence of how do you do that existing requirement? And the same with those vulnerability assessments. The vulnerability assessment, it's a survey, again, qualitative, to say, okay, where do we need to look more in our current processes, in our master planning processes, in our military construction projects, in our natural resource management? Where are those decisions, and how do we then bring that thought process in? So, all right.
Thank you. One more question for Steve, actually. Among your many duties here, you also serve on Secretary Kerry's Foreign Policy Advisory Board. The Secretary just announced a doubling of adaptation aid in Paris. Obviously, this isn't DOD funding, but can this address security threats as well, the climate security threats as
well? Yeah, I mean, the Green Fund, yeah. I think, is what you're referencing here, in, of which, of course, ASP is a big fan. Yeah. Of course, we consider climate change a threat, as I've mentioned, we've all mentioned here. So no doubt the security aspects to it are a plus. So anything you can do to help mitigate the threats from climate change, and the Green Fund does a lot of that, especially in developing countries, is of huge importance. And the problem is getting other people to buy in. And as I understand it, at COP21 today, that's one of the biggest problems they're talking about, is the contribution the countries are making, particularly to third world countries, and who's paying the bill for those countries to do that, and what's the contribution going to be. And that's the sticking point today, as I understand it.
Yeah.
Hoping that they'll get over it today or tonight and make an agreement. But yes, it can help on the security side of the house.
Yeah. It, for everybody who says, oh, doom and gloom at COP, this is the way it always plays out.
Absolutely.
It always goes to the end and then over the end, and, you know, everybody complains that they're not getting enough sleep, and then something turns up.
Well, when you have 190 or 200 countries trying to, you can imagine. I mean, it's chaos, I hope they come to an agreement.
Well, great. Thank you. I'll open it out to the floor here, and we've got a microphone coming around. So when it comes to you, will you identify yourself and your affiliation, and then we'll go from here. We'll start in the front with Adam here. Down here.
Adam Siegel, Insight Through Analysis. Thank you very much. It was a useful, interesting presentation. Let's take an analogy, which the energy world, one of the big problems, fully burdened cost of fuel, is the cost to buy versus the cost to own, total ownership cost. Almost every acquisition decision, the acquisition price is running the game, and the total ownership cost. Climate, in many ways, on infrastructure and otherwise, is similar. You know, if we're placing the base 3 feet higher for water facilities to reduce risk for sea level rise and otherwise, can we discuss a little bit of how that's being dealt with or the challenges of that within the building?
And just to clarify, you're talking about in terms of project decisions?
Project decisions and how, money, resources to do
that. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, again, we're not in We're not asking the components to invest specifically on climate change. We're saying as you're making an investment decision, consider the climate change risks associated with that decision. So like my examples on the wastewater treatment plant, we had to build the wastewater, rebuild that wastewater treatment plant because the current one was failing and was not in compliance with the rules. The climate change aspect of it was a factor in its location. It was not the driver. And so that's the way we're looking at it right now, is what do we need to do to perform the mission? The powertrain facility in Corpus Christi was a mission need. We needed that facility to address the ability to be able to rebuild those engines and maintain those engines. So again, mission-focused investment, climate change is a factor in that decision process.
I think I saw one in the back here. Yeah, Swathi, right there, right next to you.
Thank you very much for all of your talks. My question is specifically for Ms. Sullivan. Firstly, thank you very much for championing the DODD. I think it's going to be a great piece of policy for DOD to institutionalize some of these issues that we're talking about. My specific question is, because of the clear linkages between national security and climate change, do you see expanded scope and support of phase zero operations specifically because of these linkages, specifically perhaps expanding institutional support for the DIIC program amongst others? Thank you.
I'm not an expert in that area, so I really can't comment. I can say in the DIIC area, it is becoming a greater focus in the proposals we're getting from the COCOMs and in where we're racking and stacking those proposals. So in this budget climate, not a lot of money going into that program, but the focus is definitely there.
Let's go. Wow, it's a lot. Let's do right here. Black
Jack. Hi, my name is Todd Wolf from UCS, and Ms. Sullivan as well. As far as the efforts that DOD are taking up to this point, are those subject, do you guys have the flexibility within your budget to do that on your own, or is that subject to congressional authorization, or will it be in the future, and how could a potential change in the administration also impact the efforts that you guys are taking to address this issue?
Well, we've been very clear that we don't have a separate budget for climate change, and so what's subject to congressional authorization is our normal budget of military construction, of operations and maintenance of facilities, of research and development. And so from that standpoint, yes, we'll get congressional authorization. We're doing a little bit of research and development in our strategic environmental research and development program. Again, all of that subject, as far as a new administration, I can't speculate. I have no idea. So what I can say is these DOD directives, once they're in place, they stay in place for years. So that becomes the rule set that we, in fact, follow. In our process. In back to the funding thing, sorry, I meant to say, that was why I highlighted those couple of military construction projects, because me, that was a bellwether of whether or not what our appropriators and authorizers would say about climate change. And when I participated in a meeting where we were talking about the 16 president's budget request when it went over, and it was interesting, I asked some of the staffers about what they thought about those projects, and climate change wasn't the factor at all that they were concerned about. They were more concerned about, well, why are they doing the wastewater treatment plant instead of the barracks, you know, type of things, you know. So that to me was a good sign that they understood that we were doing this for mission reasons, and that's where we were focused. And we were making sure that as we do these, because like the Admiral said, like Leo said, we buy these equipment, they last 70 years. We buy buildings, they're going to last for 80 to 100 years. So are we making the investments today to make sure that we will still have access and ability to use that resource 75 years in the future?
You know, it's an interesting question when you talk about contingency funding, especially for operations. And I reference Superstorm Sandy, and people say, well, what did that have to do with the military? It was an Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, Air National Guard, and National Guard response to Sandy, and somebody paid for it.
Yep.
It came out of the DOD budget, whether it was OCO funding or somewhere. And the same line, Admiral Locklear talks about climate change. Well, he had Typhoon Haiyan, where 12,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines went down to the Philippines, and pretty much were the only big international force to do that humanitarian operation. We paid for it. I mean, it came out of somebody's budget. So the combatant commanders are going to the joint staff, and they're going back to the services and the service secretaries to OSD saying, we got to have a budget for this stuff. And climate change is causing it. So it might not necessarily be a budget for climate change, but it's going to be a budget for operations that have to be that are being caused because of climate change.
Question for Steve or Leo. Who's got one? Keep it balanced here.
I don't mind Maureen answering.
I'm Will Knuckles. In this capacity, questions are my own. Sorry, it is for Maureen.
Hi, Bill.
A question about the broad applicability of the directive. So, and specifically in the Army, is it going to apply to the military support side of the Corps of Engineers the same way? Well, the civil work side, and if I can tack on a second one, as it relates to how people are broadly thinking about how military departments will interact with other agencies. Typically, comments on the military mission relate to things like, you're in my flight line, your building's too tall, that sort of stuff. So will there be a tone change commenting on how other federal activities will affect the military mission on the whole with this climate change sort of rubric wrapped around it?
Well, you've asked several different questions here. First of all, civil works, no, right? Correct? So the civil work side of the Corps of Engineers, it will not apply to. They have separate statutory authority, so they have a different rule set. As far as what's going on around the base type of thing, this instruction will not impact that. However, there are other things going on. You know, we have a whole, there's a separate DOD issuance that's dealing with what we call our clearinghouse, and it is how we get, work with on citing of activities outside the fence that could impact our flight lines, our radar, all of that. So that is a different policy direction that is going on, but it is going on at the same time. So I hope that answers your question, Bill.
Well, I'm going to ask Leo a question if no one else is. Leo, in a lot of our events, we have ROTC members there or young second lieutenant National Guard members or things like that. And they'll often ask, well, so what does this mean to me in my career, upcoming career in the military? You know, what do you say to somebody who's coming up through the ranks, a junior officer or a non-commissioned officer, or how is this going to is climate change going to come into their career? And how should they think about this?
Yeah, a good, great question. So I think that the answer is we don't know. But what we do know is that climate change is a threat multiplier. So the without action, the probability that you as a second lieutenant or a junior officer will be deployed in response to a contingency is probably higher or just as high. And certainly I would say that just as Admiral Locklear had said, the probability of you replying responding to humanitarian assistance or disaster relief caused by an extreme weather event is higher than it has been in the past. That is a certainty. But again, the notion that climate change is going to impact resources and nations will have difficulties managing less resources with an increasing population is a crossing of two points that portends itself to increased conflict.
Yeah.
You know, you stole that question from that second lieutenant down in Charleston.
Yeah, absolutely.
who asked that question last week.
But yeah.
I mean, and it's a it's a great question, but I just want to point something out about the trip, that when we went to colleges and universities, it's kind of a friendly audience, if you will. They lean a little bit more perhaps on the left side. But the younger, this is Cheney's opinion, the younger audiences were much more involved in it. The students and the under 30 crowd, boy, they were into this and very much anxious. But those a little bit older, a little bit settled, kind of not so sure about this climate change stuff. And whereas the second lieutenant, and my little analogy about the Lance Corporal on the Hill and the solar array, which is a true story, that's where the kid on the tactical level, who's my analogy is as a second lieutenant forward observer, is sitting there saying, I'm sick of lugging batteries around and, yep, and pumping oil. You know, I would much rather, a Marine will tell you, they much rather have bullets than that stuff. And so they came up, they're the ones who have the ideas. Yeah. You know, I'm not there. I hate to say it, I'm way too old. But they're the ones who are the imagination runs wild with these kids. And they're the ones who are going to come up with a lot of solutions to this kind of stuff. And that would be my challenge to them, is to say, hey, it's your turn. You go out there. I don't have the answers, but you know, we're polluting the environment, and we've got energy problems. Help us fix it.
Yeah, if I could just add on to the age observation, one of the largest, greatest partners that we have when we go around the country is the Young Conservatives for Energy Reform, and that's typically an under 40, probably under 30 crowd who recognizes that, you know, our continued use of fossil fuels is problematic. You know, there's only so much in the United States, regardless of how much we frack. We can only frack at a certain price point, which we're way below now. So if you look at the statistics, and I'm going off the subject a little bit, but if you look at the statistics, our ability to produce oil in the United States has gone down significantly in the last year because of how low the price is, and companies that were in fracking are going out of business. So you can make the argument that, you know, we are still, as long as we continue to have a fossil fuel-based economy, we are going to continue to be influenced and dependent upon foreign oil and the influence of foreign governments. So those young people understand that, and they are very anxious to move to something other than fossil fuel, whether that's wind, solar, even nuclear.
Fusion.
Yeah. Fusion.
Ma'am in front here.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Hayden from Sandia National Laboratories. I'm curious. I have to qualify. I've been away on sabbatical for 2 years, so I haven't been in the belly button of watching the DOD funds and what Sandia is doing in research. But I haven't heard like a common theme about how we're going to tie together the risk assessments that are being done and some of the perspectives you're getting into guiding research and development priorities from DOD. Is that happening somewhere to take all this information that's being gathered and try to put it comprehensively into whether it's you know, operations in the field or whether it's logistics or what it is across DOD?
Well, that's a multi-formed question here. So let me just say a couple of things. One is there is a lot of research and development going on in the energy world, particularly military-specific energy needs. So because, you know, you talked about how much energy we use. The bulk of the energy that we use is actually for our weapon systems, for the planes, the ships, the tanks, and all of that. And so there is research going on in that area quite a bit. There is some limited research going on related to facility type of energy things. Our research tends to be focused on military-specific unique. And if we have an office building, it's the same challenges as anybody else has an office building. So on the facility energy, the military uniqueness stuff is a little bit less, I'll say. What we do have in that area is what under our Environmental Security Technology Certification Program is demonstration validation. We say we're open for business. If you have a technology and you want to prove it out, come and see us because we're a willing partner for people that are moving out of the lab and want to do full-scale demonstration. For climate change writ large, how is the climate changing? Again, not a DoD unique issue. So our interest in our investment is much more limited into how do we take that information to be able to use it at the installation level in our decision-making process. And we have some limited research, again, under the Strategic Environmental and Research Development Program in that area. So kind of like three bins of where they, we are in the R&D world. I think I've captured everything. Yeah. I'm looking to Becky behind, sitting behind you. Does that help?
You know, Steve and I gave a presentation at Argonne National Lab. I think their funding is DHS funding on this, but on climate research.
Yeah. Argonne National Lab. Yeah. It's a program that Ms. Sullivan just mentioned. Yeah, Argonne's been supporting that, but it's been interesting because we're now able to capitalize on that investment DoD's made and apply it to some of the programs that DHS is running and be able to downscale climate data, these global climate models, using our supercomputer on a regional level, and that is... That's what the mayors and the local community planners need and want desperately in order to plan for the future.
Thank you.
Yeah, under the guise of you're never too old to learn something new, our trip to Argonne was just an eye-opener. You know, of course, not the least of which you see all these steam pipes over this World War II buildings. I mean, you're going there, it's all cement block. You kind of go, my God, but you know, I didn't know it's run by the University of Chicago, which kind of blew my mind. And virtually every place went into, particularly the battery technology place, was at us and said, they're not funding us to the level we ought to be funded, and particularly on battery technology. And I'll just give another, it wasn't off the record because the guy told us, I said, you know, I really would like to get a Tesla, but they're too expensive. He goes, the Tesla's battery technology is 20 years plus old technology in the batteries. What we have are generations better than that. And so my thought was, well, why is Tesla using it? Because it works. And it's proven, and they know that's the case.
It's reliable.
And they said, but you know, if you buy one now, in 5 years, we're going to have a battery that's going to be, that'll go 10, 20 times the distance. So I'm not going to buy a Tesla. I can't afford it anyway. But in the same thing, we've met with Ernie Moniz and DOE on the energy side of the house, particularly on fusion energy. And we've been to Capitol Hill a number of times. And the whole thing is you need to commit significant money to R&D across the spectrum, and it continues to get cut, especially in the physical constraint environment that we're living in today. And we're very familiar with the fusion side of the house because we got a guy who's really nuts about it. We like fusion too. The problem is now we're funding the ITER in France and we're funding our system here to about equal amounts, and there's a fight in Congress to cut one or the other. And that's just disappointing that they're doing the nearsighted thing when they ought to be looking farsighted.
If you want to learn more about that, come to our briefing on the Hill on Tuesday from noon to 1, Senate Dirksen Office Building. It's on the website. Russell Office Building.
Open to the public. Free lunch.
Open to the public.
That's one question.
Sir, we got in the back. Yeah.
Thank you all very much. My name is Ted Vogel. Company called 12 South International. So I have a question for the gentleman and for Madam Sullivan. For the gentleman, this is tongue-in-cheek, but with a serious undertone. How do you put Admiral Weathervane and Senator Snowball in the same room and have the same result as Mr. Fracking Company in Pennsylvania? Because that seems to be a big part of the problem when it comes to things like funding around all of this and the politics and the messaging. And for Madam Sullivan, as far as NEPA compliance goes for doing any type of renewable energy projects on bases, it's severely problematic from a company point of view. And then the other thing is, I was at the Holland on the Hill event that General Cheney was at a few months ago, and Mars and DSM are both pricing carbon into all of their plans, like today. Yeah. DSM, I think it's 30 euros or 50 euros a ton, and Mars, I think, was 30. Where is the DoD leaning into that, or is there any modeling around that, or?
Well, we wish we had the slide that we put up, and it shows Senator
Inhofe
from Oklahoma with the snowball standing on the floor and said, this is climate change, here's a snowball. It snowed in Washington in February. Well, no kidding.
And
Yeah, and it's that kind of an attitude. It's almost like Trump, who stands up and says something so outrageous, but you don't have the right there to stand up. The 60-second soundbite's not going to counter what he said. But when you take an Admiral Titley and he lays it out very specifically, the science, and to me it's a slam dunk. The educated person is going to understand that, hey, this is happening, and it's a big problem. So that's my answer on the snowball and the Admiral in the same room and the fracking guy. We just did it just out of curiosity more than anything else to hear what he had to say. And at the end, this was a smart guy now, a smart businessman making a lot of money fracking. So he didn't like our message at all. he didn't. He was selling gas.
Yeah.
But he understood it. You know, I'm telling you, he got it, and Titley had him cornered, so he couldn't counter the arguments. Just a quick thing on carbon tax and cap and trade, and that business. ASP has always been a kind of an all-the-above organization. If there's no one item is going to solve the entire problem, it's going to take a lot of things to do it. So we've not commented on cap and trade or carbon tax, but if you read the latest Economist issue, it talks that cap and trade still allows you to emit, you know, and gives out freedom to pollute more, whereas a carbon tax reduces that. So I mean, there's I'm sure this is all going to be part of I hope COP21, but I'm not sure how it's going to come out.
This is non-attributable. So the way that you need to do that is you need to buy every advertising spot you can on Fox News and on conservative talk radio, because they are appealing to a certain sect of people, and that sect of people are getting their information for that same group, so it's a circular argument. I will claim that I listen to conservative talk radio, and Rush Limbaugh said the other day that the Arctic is not melting. Flat-out statement. It's flat-out a lie. It's untrue. You know. But there was no additional discussion about that, so the millions of people that listen to that radio show that ascribe to that, and they now have that in their mind. And so, as you know, all politics are local. To get elected, you've got to meet the views of your constituents, and so you've got to be very careful about what you say in the terms of your constituents. So the answer is to get the true facts out to the people that understand it, you know, the unfiltered facts. And it's just incredible to me that there are so many that think this is a conspiracy of 97% of the scientists to do something to, I guess, spread the wealth around. I don't know. But having guys like General Cheney go out and talk to people, you know, the military, that's one of the advantages of these types of organizations, is that the military is still very trusted. And so when they speak, you know, apolitical, they're not representing any policies. And that's why at CNA we try to be very careful about not, you know, being very down the middle and not being associated with, you know, one organization or the other, but just putting out the facts and how they affect the security. Hopefully those messages will start to resonate. I will tell you that when you talk to some of those politicians behind closed doors or to their staffs, they get it, they understand it, and they want to do things about it. I think that's why, you know, here 2 weeks ago or a month ago, you saw the 11 Republican congressmen sign the resolution that climate change is real and the GOP needs to do something about it. The fact that 9 of them aren't running for re-election tells you something. that's the heart. That's what they believe in their heart. But now they don't have to get elected. They don't have to have the party behind them in order to get elected. They can say what they believe and what that is. So I think that's part of the challenge, is this whole electability thing.
Maureen, NEPA compliance and internal carbon price.
Yeah. So NEPA presents challenges, I will readily admit that. So and separate from just the climate change, I'm pushing my staff to look at more efficiencies in the NEPA process. I joke we pay consultants by the pound for NEPA documents, but the truth is there has to be substantive analysis, and so I see two things. We're going down a couple of different paths. One is Under NEPA, there's the categorical exclusions. We haven't added to our list of categorical exclusions in like 10 years, if not more. So we're embarking on an effort to add more categorical exclusions, which is a whole process. You have to go through CEQ. You have to go through a notice and comment in the Federal Register. So that's number one. Number two is digitizing the current information so we don't have to pay for the analysis over and over and over again, so that it could streamline the process. So that's a second effort that I think will help the NEPA process itself. Because the truth is, the NEPA law has been on the books for many years. There's a lot of court analysis, so the process is what it is. What we need to look for is more efficiencies in how we execute it as it's written. And so I'm empathetic of the challenges, and we're really trying to figure out how to make that more efficient. Now, the cost of carbon, that's an interesting one. I actually sit on a GSA advisory board on green buildings, and this is one of the things that this advisory board is grappling with right now, is how to get the federal government to think about the cost of carbon when we're making investment decisions. And the challenge, I will tell you, is that the inability within the federal government to look at life cycle costs. Somebody mentioned it there. Our budget is based on initial price. And so it's really hard to get the Office of Management and Budget to start thinking beyond that. And so it'll be interesting to see what this advisory board comes up with in terms of recommendations to the White House. This is actually under the Energy Independence and Security Act, that GSA was mandated to have this federal advisory committee. So I say it's GSA, but the recommendations actually go to the White House on what it is. So I'm sitting there as part of that. The department's not doing anything specifically on carbon tax, but really watching to where the federal government is going to go writ large. At this point, I just don't know.
We have time for one closing question, so let's do right here. Make it a good one.
Very simple question, just to finish up. I'm Christina Matha with the Christian Science Monitor. I'm wondering, when you're making these plans and these investments for the future in terms of climate adaptation, how important is the COP21? Are you preparing for 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, 2.7, 4, somewhere in between?
Let me just say that a specific, we're not aiming for a specific number. So as my boss says, you know, sea level rise is going to go, you know, 14 inches or 12 inches. I don't care. It's going to be in that range. So when I think getting tied to a very specific number is going to hamper us, and we have to look at a range as we're making that decision. And so I personally have not really been paying attention to what's going on in COP. So that's, I know there are many other people in the Department of Defense that have. So,
any final thoughts, Steve, Leah?
Well, just anecdotal again about the politics of the business, and coming from my prior home state of South Carolina. When you poor Bob Inglis, I'm sure many here know it, when he talked climate change in his primary run after being elected already twice, was slammed by his opponent and got lost in the primary. Of course, he's now working at George Mason. But now you've got Lindsey Graham saying, yep, the climate change is real. And he's starting to shift his attitude toward it. And he's the big boy down there in South Carolina. So if those people are starting to change, maybe there's a little hope and opportunity here. I to echo what Leo said, I sat down with the chief of staff of a very, 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 very senior senator, so that narrows it down, and he got it all, bought everything we were saying. And I said, well, yeah, but how come your senator's not saying any of this? He says, his electorate won't vote for him. And that built to exactly what you were saying. Until that starts to shift, and sooner or later I think it will shift when this younger generation comes up and we tell them the national security implications, we'll make a difference. Leo?
Yeah, climate change is real. It's happening. You know, it's affecting 7.3 billion people. That's the difference.
Great.
It's always been that.
Maureen, any final thoughts?
Well, one thing we've talked about energy here, right? And one thing that I've been advocating, we really need to start thinking seriously about water. And I don't know that we've paid as much attention to water. Access to accessibility, volume, is there enough water? In water in terms of is a, access to availability of water is a an accelerant for destabilization. Mm-hmm. We really need to start thinking more seriously about water.
Certainly people in California have been thinking about that for the last year or so.
But Puerto Rico is under severe drought as well.
That's right. That's right. Ethiopia is is facing a very tough winter. Anyway, thank you. Thank you all for your time, and thanks to the panelists.